Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's CBI at 10 on the very important and timely subject of helping your employees through the cost of living squeeze. I'm Giles Whittell. I'm an editor at Tortoise, and I'm delighted to be joined by Eugenia Migliori, who is Principal Policy Advisor Inclusion at the CBI's Changing Workforce Programme, and by Redeema Durham, Chief Commercial Officer at Salary Finance. I don't know about you, but I am already involved regularly in conversations with colleagues about the cost of living squeeze and with my family about the cost of Weetabix, and shrinkflation is a particular bugbear in my household as orange juice cartons get smaller. But let's get straight to it, because we're just going to run for half an hour today and try and get through as much as possible that is as useful as possible for members. Eugenia, let me start with you. And as usual, perhaps the best thing is if you can give us, first of all, a heads up on what is generally preoccupying the CBI this week.
Thank you, Giles. So a very busy week for the CBI and a couple of things worth sharing with the audience. First one, the Prime Minister's new cost of living SAR, David Butters, was in CBI building this week, meeting members, so that's very good. David is the founder and former CEO of Just Eat and has been appointed as cost of living SAR. Since his appointment, he has kind of engaged a couple of times with us, which is crucial at these difficult times for businesses and workers. So he's really keen to work with businesses and has a good understanding of the things that many companies are already doing to support the public, to support customers, employees, and society more broadly. He's got a six-month role and has said himself the question, how can government support what businesses are already doing to ease the cost of living crisis? So he talked to us about some of the things he has already seen from firms and made reference to a number of CBI members. And I guess, you know, it's great to see that he's aware of these initiatives. He also sort of mentioned the government's campaign that will be launched in early July with a particular focus on school holidays, which is obviously a very sort of expensive time for families. Mm. And I guess the campaign will be about recognizing the efforts of businesses who are kind of sort of trying to help consumers with the rising cost of living and sort of amplifying and spreading the message of these initiatives. And the campaign, you know, now is kind of sort of focused on school holidays, but will be focused on other expensive moments in the, you know, later in the year, like back to school and the Christmas period. So we're really keen to work with him, showcasing the good work that members are doing to help those that are struggling the most. So please, you know, get in touch if you want to share any of these examples with us. And I guess the second thing this week for the CBI is our DG, Tony, is going to be in France. He will be attending the Franco-British Colloque and will be sort of representing the interest of UK business. So this is like an annual kind of sort of event to improve relations between French and UK businesses and politicians. And it's like a mini Davos for the great and good of French society. But genuinely speaking, it's an important event that includes the presence of Liz Truss, French Minister for Europe, and many, many others. So it's a really good opportunity to engage on things like climate change and the energy crisis, the impact, of course, of Ukraine on energy and supply chains, and of course, the bilateral trade relations between the two nations. And last, but definitely not least, the CBI has a new president. Yesterday at our annual general meeting, CBI members elected Brian McBride as the new CBI president for a two-year term, and our former president, Lord Karen Villamoria, will now be the vice president. And I guess a bit about Brian, he's from Glasgow. He's currently a chair at Trainline and a non-executive director at Standard Life Aberdeen. He's been the chairman of ASOS between 2010 and 2018, and the CEO of Amazon UK between 2006 and 2011. But I guess the most important thing is that he's absolutely lovely, and we're all really looking forward to working with him. And I'm sure there will be opportunities for our members in the coming weeks and months to meet him. So those are the main three things that are happening at the CBI this week.
Great. Well, thank you. A lot happening. And actually, some better than usual mood music at the top on Franco-British relations, we should note. Hard to miss that great big arm around the shoulder, Johnson around Macron. Very briefly, Eugenia, what are you hearing from members about what they are already doing, never mind government campaigns, what they're already doing off their own bat to help staff deal with the cost of living crisis, given that it's probably not as simple as just paying them more?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, look, times are very tough for both firms and families. And, you know, the cost of doing business is increasing. And this is also impacting businesses' ability to sort of operate. But I guess the main thing is, like, businesses, you know, do understand how important it is to support their staff. And that's why increasingly they are reaching out to us to hear what other firms are doing. And we sort of building that kind of little network where we can share all these examples. So as you say, I mean, there are things around pay as well. So a lot of examples of companies offering kind of sort of one-off payment to employees to help cope with rising costs. And that's something you can see through the labor market statistics every month, you know, the proportion of employers paying bonuses is kind of sort of increasing, with the expectation that inflation is going to ease back in 2023, right? So they are kind of sort of seeing that as a way to support staff at this very moment.
So but the preference is lump sums rather than building in a permanent raise necessarily.
Exactly, because we're expecting, and that's something that came across as well in our own forecast, we are expecting inflation to ease back in 2023. So businesses are kind of sort of saying, okay, let's kind of sort of offer, you know, one-off payments to support people with the cost of living crisis now, because also kind of sort of increases around 9-10% in pay are, for a lot of businesses in some sectors, is just unaffordable. So we've seen kind of sort of that strategy a lot. But I guess for those companies that cannot really offer these kind of sort of pay increases or like one-off payment, they are kind of exploring other ways of supporting people and trying to be kind of more innovative. So for example, some firms have told us that they are sort of ramping up discounted lunches in the workplace or exploring with travel providers how to make travel tickets work for those that are kind of sort of working hybridly. Firms are also giving employees more flexibility to work from home, which obviously has helped staff struggling to meet increasing transport and fuel costs. We heard from businesses as well that some kind of sort of have changed their, the working pattern of some people to enable employees to work, for example, over the weekend. And, you know, this way staff can sort of save on childcare costs during the week, for example. So that's, you know, that's kind of some of the stuff that we are hearing. Of course, we also hearing about kind of sort of greater flexibility around wages too, for example, by allowing staff to sell back unused annual leave. And this is an interesting one because, you know, we think that people have to take annual leave, they have to rest. It's important for people's mental health. But in some occasions, you know, people, because of COVID, they have kind of a lot of days of unused annual leave. So some businesses are kind of saying, okay, if you want to kind of sort of get the money instead of that, we can do that. Or, for example, adopting tools that offer workers instant access to earned pay. So they have kind of sort of, you know, better sort of cash flow. There are more examples that I can share with you, but I'm sure we can kind of sort of touch on those a bit sort of later in the call.
Redeema, tell us what Salary Finance does and then a bit about the research that you've done recently on backing people through the cost of living squeeze. News you can use.
So Sally Finance was founded in 2015, very much with the mission to kind of help millions of people become financially healthier and happier. And effectively what we do is we partner with some of the UK's sort of largest, most engaged employers to effectively, and Eugenia mentioned kind of one of those products just now with the salary, advancing your salary, but effectively that's one of our products to basically provide salary-linked financial well-being benefits to employees through the employer. So we kind of do easily digestible financial education, salary advances, which is the product Eugenia just mentioned, low-cost loans and saving solutions as our kind of primary product set. We work with almost 600 employers now, including kind of some, you know, 9 out of 10 of the largest retailers, so all the big names that you would have heard of. Boots, Tesco's, Sainsbury's, but also employers like sort of BT, Experian, Vodafone, many NHS trusts, 20% of the FTSE.
The government partner for Help to Save, is that right?
Yes, and we are the government partner for Help to Save. So we have instant access saving, and then we are integrated into the Help to Save account with the government as well. So a number of our employers. So our employers can kind of mix and match which. You know, we're very much a holistic solution, and you know, I think we built a fairly robust kind of holistic suite of tools to help employees build their kind of financial resilience, and so employers can basically choose whether they have absolutely everything or they have some selection of the products. So Help to Save and Save is a big part of it. So we're now reaching about 1 in 10 employees in the UK, around 4.5 million. So certainly not everyone, but growing. And I really think that this time especially is where we're really, really seeing a big pull from employers with an increased focus on financial well-being. And it's definitely a transition of appetite. I think, you know, employers have always kind of been involved in financial well-being, but typically it's kind of been quite a different relationship. You know, they've always been thinking about long-term financial well-being products like pensions, life assurance, and so on. Whereas now employers really need to start and are starting thinking about how they can provide access to tools and supports that can help them and help employees with where they are now, rather than planning for post-work life or how life might look like after retirement. And I do think, you know, as people's expectation with work transitions from kind of purely transactional to more of an actual relationship, this support that you know, all of the different pieces that Eugenia is talking about, really it does feel like it's the employer's responsibility to be there for their employees, and it's not just about pay, you know. And that's kind of an interesting segue into the research as well, which I can talk about now, yeah, now if you'd like.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. So this research is basically, you know, we find that it's kind of interesting what you were saying about the bonuses and the pay. However, within our ecosystem, we definitely find that most employers can't afford to just keep paying their people more to offset the increased cost of living. And actually, an interesting thing about our research as well is that it's not necessarily so obvious that the increased pay actually offsets those issues. Obviously it does to some extent, but that is kind of one of the points of our research, that it's affecting everyone, not just the lowest earners.
Just to be clear, that is that because inflation is running at the level of it is, so that if you were only to deploy pay rises as the solution, they would just have to be so big that it would bust everybody's budgets?
Yes, and I think that's partially true, but we also just find, yes, that's absolutely partially true, but also in general, we do find that people who earn more are slightly less worried about their financial situation, however, not dramatically so. And you know, they still actually say that it has the same level of negative impact on their mental health. Earning a big salary isn't a sort of one-way ticket to financial well-being and resilience. Sometimes when you're in that cycle, it is about getting out of that cycle. Let's say it's a high cost debt cycle. And this is kind of, you know, supported by research that we've done, but also like Aviva research that found that those in senior positions are more likely than the average employee to say their finances are keeping them awake at night, or, you know, 36% of people who lost income during the pandemic have run down their savings, leaving little to no rainy day fund for future uncertainties. And I do think, to be honest, those on higher income sets sometimes have that lifestyle to support them, and therefore maybe an equal financial distress than someone who's on a lower income, because actually their lifestyle and the maintenance that they have to do has gone to that level. If I just talk about the research a bit then, yeah. So we surveyed nationally representative kind of sample of employees across the country to ask them how they were coping financially, how the crisis was impacting their mental health, because as we kind of now know, financial and mental well-being are so interlinked, and then also how it was impacting their work or relationship with their employer. So one of the biggest stats is that 53% of UK employees are struggling more with their finances since COVID. So that's 15.6 million working people. 70% of them find themselves short by at least £600 annually, with two in three of those short by about £1,200 each year. So that is, you know, genuinely the shortcoming that people are finding themselves. And then interestingly, one in four women use, you know, buy now, pay later schemes, which is a big new product in the market when they need more money. Typically, this is kind of twice the amount of men. And you know, this kind of aligns with recent YouGov findings as well, that 6 in 10 Britons who are already in financial difficulty expect their situation to get much worse in the next year. So about half of the UK workforce we found say that they're worried about their financial situation and it's affecting their mental well-being. 51% of them worry about it every day of the week, with 23% saying 51% overall say that they worry about their financial situation every day of the week, with 23% saying they're worrying multiple times a day. And then 95% of those that do say they worry about their financial situation, which is that 50%, say it's having a very negative effect on their mental health, which is, you know, approximately 23 million people. And so this is sort of our research, but also corroborated by a lot of other research out there with Aviva. The recent Aviva research suggested that 3 in 5 employees agree that their finances, at least at some times, seem like they're controlling their lives. And this sort of seems to rise to about 83% of Gen Z and 71% for Generation Y. So I think it's you also asked kind of what's surprising. I think one of the key things that's surprising, I think, is that people, you know, women are disproportionately affected. It's not just the low income earners, which is what we just discussed. And also 3 in 4 of those who are affected by the mental health piece say that it would improve if their employer gave them some sort of immediate access to financial well-being support and benefits. We also found quite a big gap. So Eugenia, you were talking about some of the kind of employee discounts and advances and other products. We found quite a big gap in the financial support and benefits that employees say they have access to versus what they think they would want or need in the next 6 months. So for example, 23% of people think they have access to employee discounts, whereas 43% of them say they would use employee discounts if they had them. So, you know, that's quite a gap. There's almost a 20% gap between the people who would want it versus feel they have access to it. Similarly with the salary advances that you were mentioning, Eugenia, 14% of employees we surveyed had access to it, but 30% said they would use it in the next 6 months. Debt consolidation is another one, which is one of the big products that we offer, for example. 4% of people surveyed said they had access to a debt consolidation type product, and 17% said they would look to be using that in the next 6 months. So it's interesting that there is quite a disconnect between either people don't know they have access to these products and services through their employer, or they just don't have them, versus what proportion would use it or feel that they might use it in the next 6 months.
Radina, that's a really useful summary of a worrying piece of research. This is a worried nation, isn't it? We've got quite a lot of questions in the chat, and Eugenia as well, feel free to jump in. A couple of them are merely factual. Can you just remind us of the size of your sample? How many people did you poll for your research, Radina?
I think it was about 10,000 people.
So that is a big number, right?
Yes.
Roughly five times what YouGov would normally use for a political poll. And another factual question, if either of you know the answer, when companies make one-off payments, are they subject to tax, income tax, national insurance? If I get a lump sum to help me with the cost of living just this year, one off, is that taxed? NI contributions taken off it?
Yeah, I think it is taxable, yes.
Yeah, it is taxable.
And then, Radina, I wanted to come back to employers' responses here. From anecdotally and from your research, what's your sense of whether employers are reading the room, paying more attention, and if so, what? I mean, we've heard a lot about what the concerns are. What are the responses from employers that you're seeing most often?
Yeah, so we are seeing, you know, we are seeing a big influx into employers for us, in trying to implement our solution, for example, as they see that it's their responsibility to step in and try and be there for their employees for financial well-being. I think typically in the past, it has all been bucketed all together, financial, physical, mental, social, and all of these schemes, you know, have sort of been taken as one or under one pillar. And so probably financial well-being has sort of been underinvested as a pillar of well-being support. But in the current crisis, it's sort of really highlighting the need for a shift in business approach to financial well-being. And so what we are seeing in terms of the response is employers are increasingly worried about it. New employers who we don't partner with yet are coming to us to sort of implement our solution, but also our current employers are basically asking for a lot more education, a lot more webinars, a lot more publicity of the support that we can offer to their employees. One anecdotally, like, our webinars are like 10 times more attended in terms of the employees than they ever were pre-COVID. You know, it used to be something that we used to put on twice a month. It would be attended, like, you know, by kind of a core demographic. And now we suddenly see that opening up to such a wide range of employees. And the questions, like, you know, we can't answer the questions sort of fast enough, and we have to have follow-up webinars to answer questions. Our head of financial education, Jason Butler, runs these. He writes for the FT as well. And he's really, like, he was talking to me the other day about the shift he's noticed in the engagement in these webinars and the tips and the, you know, he has a smart spending system and the engagement that we're now getting with all of this, with all of the services we've been providing for a long time. But suddenly employees and employers are sort of waking up to the impact of it.
Thank you. Before we run out of time, Eugenia, I can see that you've put your finger in up to your mouth anyway, but whatever else you wanted to say, I want to put to you another question from a member in the chat. We can't afford to offer back pay or one-off bonuses to our employees, but we are concerned about their well-being and rise in cost of living. What do you recommend that we do?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And I was kind of thinking while Radina was speaking that, you know, to end kind of sort of on a more positive note, I suppose, you know, mental health and well-being has been a priority for businesses for a long time, you know, and I know this myself because at the CBI, we've been working on this topic for at least 5 years. So we have a couple of reports available in our website with examples of things businesses are doing to support people's mental health. We did publish one in 2019 where, you know, the world was kind of normal-ish. But then we published a second one in 2021 with all the examples that businesses, the actions that businesses have taken throughout the pandemic. And it's just impressive to see how businesses have mental health and well-being front of their minds kind of thing. So there are a lot of examples there, running surveys every week to check how people are feeling, how people are doing, providing, for example, free apps or kind of sort of build some apps for them to kind of check in how they're doing, kind of having weekly conversations about these. There are companies, for example, that the CEO himself calls random people kind of sort of in the, from the staff and kind of checks in how the person is doing, for example, or offering, private medical insurance. So there are a lot of examples there. I guess also the good news is that the CBI itself has a health area now. This used to be part of our work and now it's just a whole area dedicated to health, well-being, physical health and mental health. So I would suggest to that person that posed that question to look and check these front of mind reports, number one, number two, because there are a lot of examples of things that people can do, expensive, free things, less expensive things, and a lot of options. But I guess the good news is that businesses have been doing this for a while, and it's not something they're just doing now because of the cost of living crisis. It's been a big priority for them for years, I would say.
Okay.
John, just to add to that. Sorry, just to add to Jenny's.
I've been told that we can run over perhaps a few minutes because there's a lot of questions. So if it's okay with you, it's okay with me.
Okay, great. Just to add to that, I completely agree with all of those things. One other thing that I would add, three things really, kind of acknowledge the cost of living squeeze. I think trying to hide away from it or not tackle it is something that is just not going to do well for you. So, acknowledge that we're all facing difficult times right now. Be sympathetic to the fact that a significant portion of your people might be struggling. Outline what help you have. And as Eugenia says, businesses do have things in place. Either implement new things or highlight what you've got and support that they can get right now, signpost external resources, your existing benefits, and then really help train your managers. That's one of the key things that we found with our employers. So many people engage much more with their own peers or line managers than they do with HR. So often businesses, train the HR team or HR team know about the resources, but actually the day-to-day line managers don't, especially in large businesses where there's a distributed workforce and many stores or stuff like that. So upskill your managers and other sort of trusted voice in your businesses on the financial well-being benefits you provide, those external resources, and kind of empower employees to be open about their situation and to be able to go to those people about them, which makes it just much more likely they can be signposted to the right tools, the right charities, without needing to be prescriptive. So as an example, we work with a few retailers who are doing that a lot, creating kind of mental and financial well-being first aiders, training their line managers, and we're actually training quite a lot of that staff in really just understanding what's out there, because as Eugenia says, there is a lot out there and businesses have been doing a lot for years. It's just, as I said about the webinars, sometimes not so well kind of received or popularized, and it kind of needs to come to the forefront now.
Yes, that point about training managers to do what might have been in an HR silo really resonates. I've only worked in rather flat journalistic organizations, but I can fully relate to the idea. I mean, you can have a meaningful conversation with people you work with all day, every day, much more likely than perhaps with someone who's just parachuted in from a department that you only see once a year. There is another question about how to administer lump sums. Are businesses looking at one-off payments to all staff, or trying to target those perceived to be most in need? And if so, how do you do that?
So look, I think it really depends on your own business. I think that that has to be sort of an assessment that the own company has to make. So there's an example of a company that, for example, this year kind of sort of got rid of increases in relation to performance. So they're not doing that anymore. They have given an increase and a bonus to all staff, regardless of kind of sort of their performances. So that's an example, for example. But there are other companies that are like, look, we are going to give like a one-off payment to those that are at the lower end of the pay distribution because they are on the minimum wage, for example, and they kind of sort of struggling more. So I guess it really depends on each, you know, in each company, and that assessment has to be done perhaps by, you know, the senior leaders in the company to really understand what the pressures, you know, the pressures are for people.
The other thing that we've seen work quite well is kind of surveying your workforce kind of before throwing potential solutions out there, sort of ask your people how they're coping and take the time to understand. And you know, there is no one size fits all. Organizations who sign posts to charities or credit unions alongside financial education, advances and loans that we provide, and also do different types of hardship funds. So we're working with an organization right now who provides kind of hardship, either grants or loans to their people, and they have to kind of make an application, and they're seeing a huge kind of rise in that, for example. So and really they've done that by serving their workforce and understanding what the different pockets of needs are. So it may be that it's the lowest paid as the question implied, or it may be actually that there's certain pockets that are particularly being impacted, and that's where your support needs to go.
My question for each of you, and I'll ask you to answer relatively briefly, is if this cost of living squeeze goes on longer than we think at the moment, then what? What is the single most useful piece of advice that you've gleaned for employers? Redeema, do you want to go first?
I would say the single most useful advice would be empathetic, communicate with your workforce, and be open and honest.
Yeah, I would echo that. I would say that it's important to be empathetic, to understand what people are going through, and to have honest conversations, and to kind of sort of understand what's happening with their finances, and trying to identify the ways to support them.
Because we are all in the same boat. More or less. Well, let's hope that the cost of living squeeze, that inflation does peak and subside later this year, as some hope. And let's hope that the pessimists are not proven right again. Thank you, Redeema. Thank you, Eugenia, very much. I should say that the next CBI at 10 is next Wednesday, at the same time, obviously, 10 o'clock. And it will shine a spotlight on the devolved nations with CBI speakers from all the devolved nations, covering everything from the Northern Ireland Protocol to the question of a second referendum in Scotland, which, as you will know if you've been paying attention, is very much on Nicola Sturgeon's mind, and as a result, on the minds of Boris Johnson and the Supreme Court. Thank you very much for joining us. I hope it's been useful, and do join TBI at 10 again, same time next week. Thanks a lot.